nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, sports fans and men about town, girls about town, good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. Good to be here. Had a little bit of time off this morning. We just couldn't get just the right guest for the first part of our show. We generally have two people. So I had a little more time just to, get confused. And now I'm doing good. Hope you are. It's a pretty exciting time in planet Earth. Lots to go on. Lots to learn. Lots to figure out how we can navigate, let's call it, our financial health and our spiritual, emotional, and physical health. And that's pretty much what we do here. We're in our 13th year for this show. And our kind of moniker has been our health, wealth, and well-being. And we try to cover all of that. And Wednesdays, we generally talk about money. That's kind of the thing what we do. And today is no exception. On the last Wednesday of the month is a fun time for us because we have an opportunity to talk to a fellow that I have a great deal of respect for. It's Richard Mayberry. On the last Wednesday, Mr. Mayberry publishes the U.S. Early Warning Report once a month. Well, 10 times a year, I believe. He was formerly the Global Affairs Editor of Money World. It's a very respected business and economics analyst in America. He is, excuse me. Many articles, major publications around the world. And what he's really famous for is his uncle's series of books. And they're flying off the shelves, I hear, because the homeschoolers are becoming more and more prolific in our culture. And we'll tell you, Mark bought the Uncle Eric series. Great books. And you can be 70 revolutions around the sun or 15, and you'll equally get a lot out of all these great books. Earlywarningreport.com is where we find his newsletter. He also is involved with an organization, ethicssolutions.net, and we'll talk about that. And it's the last Wednesday, so it's a pleasure to say good morning to Mr. Richard Mayberry. Hello.
Good morning, Patrick. Good to hear from you again.
Well, we try to do it once a month when I remember. It's good.
Yes. Right. I always look forward to these. You do such a great job.
Oh, well, you're and, nice.
There are so few people out there giving the alternative or any alternative view to the mainstream press. And you do a wonderful job of opening people's eyes, I think. And I think it's a really great thing. And thank you very much from me personally. I appreciate it very much. You do great work.
My pleasure. So you're a kind of libertarian guy, pretty much. And what are you doing out there in Socialistville? I mean, that's pretty interesting. You're in California.
That's one of the places we live.
Uh-huh.
It's just we're here. Well, we both came to California when my wife was 12 and when I was 16. And so we basically lived most of our adult life here. And it used to be just a wonderful place, just, what America was really all about, the land of opportunity and also wonderful weather, all sorts of great things about California. But as you say, I mean, it's just gone so heavily socialist that it's just coming apart at the seams, and people are fleeing California like there's some kind of plague here or something.
Really?
I mean, there's a area in Idaho, southern Idaho, that happens to be an area that's kind of like what California was like, let's say, 40 years ago, 50
really?
Years ago. And that area in southern Idaho is just filling up with Californians. it's driving the natives there crazy because there's just exodus from California to southern Idaho to try to escape the socialism of California. Because, socialism is a big hoax. It always has been. People rise to power in the government by promising all these socialist wonders, And it never comes to pass. What actually happens is socialism destroys the economy, and the place gets worse and worse, and that's what's happening to California. If there's anybody listening to us who is thinking about voting socialist in the upcoming elections, I hope you will come visit, for instance, San Francisco for a little while to find out what it's really going to be like if you get what you're voting for. California is nothing like it used to be. It's being wrecked by socialism.
Is there something more extreme going on in the last 4, 5, or 10 years or so, Mr. Mayberry, other than, you know, California's always been pretty left, right? I guess they've been what they call a blue state for a long time. But is it something else going on now, do you think, philosophically or socially, if I can use the word, in the culture out there?
The California culture has really been destroyed by the handouts, the welfare handouts. It's become known all around the country that California has a very liberal socialist policy of taking care of anybody who shows up, and so you have people who are normally found only in dark alleys flooding into California to get all the freebie handouts. And San Francisco is probably the worst case of it. It's just horrible there. In large parts of it, I shouldn't say the whole city is that way, but the vagrants show up. They expect the city government to take care of them with taxpayer money, and they sleep on the sidewalks and live in the parks and roam around the city. And it's gotten so bad that the Public Works Department in San Francisco has a, I guess you'd call it a program, for cleaning up the human feces that is deposited on the sidewalks in San Francisco. And even before COVID-19 wrecked everything, there were 28,000 cases per year of people from the Public Works Department having to clean up the sidewalk where one of these vagrants had decided to, leave his human waste. It's just unbelievable. You got to wear boots if you're going to walk around in San Francisco. And that's what you're voting for. If you're voting for socialism, you're voting for all the people you don't want to be with to be with you and to live with you. And, talk to somebody in San Francisco and see what it's like. It's just a horrible thing. And that's what socialism has always done all around the world, and it's really become entrenched in California. It used to be that, California was the land of opportunity. People would come from all over the United States to participate in the growing industries in California. And California is, even today, I think, it's like the 6th or 7th largest economy in the world.
Yes.
And that's because all of these people came from all around the United States because there was more opportunity here than anywhere else. It was a very free market capitalist type of system. I'm going back like to the 1950s and 60s where, the weather was wonderful and these industries were being established here. And all of the best people in the United States, I shouldn't say all, but huge numbers of the best people in the country would come here to participate in these new industries and live the good life. Probably at that time, actually now that I think about it, California probably offered the best way of life of any place on earth at that time. But gradually, the socialists took over the schools and the colleges and taught all the children of these immigrants from the rest of the country to believe in socialism. And so now the population votes for socialism and the place is being wrecked. Just it's it's a kind of a small version of what happened in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics.
I was kind of thinking that it would be different from there, but not so. In other words, in Union of what do they call it? Union USSR and Venezuela and these other socialist countries that failed. Did they have the same theory and expectations about immigrations and giving people things similar to what's going on in California? Same.
Actually, that's a good point. Generally, once socialism is well established, there's not much immigration going on because nobody wants to move there. And the people that, by and large, are moving into California are the kind who are usually on the street corner begging. They're not scientists and engineers and all that are coming from the rest of the country. It's the kind of people who have failed in life that are coming to California and expecting to be taken care of. So like Venezuela, you know, who's going to emigrate to Venezuela or when the USSR existed? Who would emigrate there? They had to build walls to keep people in, to keep them from leaving. So, maybe that's the direction California is headed. There's going to be a version of the Berlin Wall all along the border of California to keep the Californians from leaving.
And of course, Mr. Trump has taken a lot of hits because of being called racist and uncompassionate and whatever because of his strong stance on border controls and immigration, you know. What do you think is a respectful and ethical way for a country to deal with people wanting to come in?
What you can't have is socialism or a welfare state, because in essence, I mean, what's going on in the United States today is that the federal government is paying people to come to America. As soon as you cross the border, you can go on welfare and be taken care of. Your kids can go to the schools. You get medical care. It's compared to living in, I don't know, let's say Venezuela or some other country south of the border, America is paradise. And so the federal government is paying these people to come here. And as long as you do that, you're going to have an influx of the type of people you don't want. So there's no solution to the immigration problem as long as the federal government is going to be giving these handouts to people when they come across the border. You've got to cut that out and require that when people come here, they be prepared to earn a living. And we've got exactly the opposite problem now. They've closed off the border, and they're keeping the people who want to work out of the country. And so I live in farm country, and the farmers cannot find people to harvest their crops and to work in the fields and do the maintenance of the crops and all of that. Those people have stopped coming because the federal government is trying to close the border. And the reason that we got the wrong people coming across the border, it's just an ungodly mess because of this socialist policy that the whole United States has of paying people to come to America.
But this has gone on through different administrations for a long time, has it not? I mean, Republican, Democrats. So the guts of the system is a socialist kind of a system, regardless of who's in office.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, socialism didn't arrive in America just, you know, bang in one fell swoop.
Right.
It started building. Probably you could fairly call the beginning of it the New Deal in the Great Depression, when Franklin Roosevelt started launching these socialist programs, like Social Security is one example. That's just a big hoax. People think that the government is taking care of them when they're on Social Security. Well, no, it's your kids that are taking care of you. The government taxes your kids to take care of you when you're on Social Security. It's a straight transfer from the pockets of your children to you. And but it's hidden, you know, it's camouflaged with all this wonderful patriotic, oh, we take care of our old people and all. It's it's just another socialist hoax.
So the money that comes out, what is it, 15%, 7.5 each, that's just, that is a paradigm that just doesn't, or as we say in Texas, that dog just doesn't hunt. I mean, it doesn't work. I mean, does it, financially, it doesn't seem to work. It doesn't,
right, yeah. It's a mess. And a big part of it is that the people are led to believe that this Social Security is some kind of an investment, that they put money into it themselves, and then they start taking the money out after they're retired.
Right.
Well, no, that money doesn't exist. There isn't any savings going
There's
on.
There's no trust fund. No.
Right, there is no trust fund. That's exactly right. They just take money from your kids and they give it to you. And they do a lot of paperwork that makes it look like there's some kind of trust fund there, but there isn't. When they get their hands on that money, it is gone immediately. It is not invested anyplace. And so, you know, the kids are just being taxed to support the retired people.
Can you recall, was it Greenspan? Do you remember? He said, well, we looked at the numbers, and I think this thing's going to run out of gas in 2025. And they doubled. It was one of the biggest tax hikes in our history, wasn't it? And
there was a big one under Ronald Reagan, too.
That's what I mean. I think that's what I'm speaking of. I think it was mid-80s, yeah. I think, didn't they double it on both ends?
I think you're right. Yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah. That's quite a while ago. But that's what's been going on all along. The first person to get a Social Security check back in the 1930s was a woman named Ida May Fuller.
Oh.
And she paid into Social Security like, you know, 3 days or something like that, and then she retired. And for the rest of her life, she got a check. And that's a good representation of the whole thing. It's just a case of stealing money from one group of people and handing it to another. And as time has gone on, so the politicians have figured out that one way to buy votes is to promise to raise the Social Security benefits. So you have these socialist politicians come along every year promising to preserve Social Security and make it bigger, make it cover more things, and these guys get elected because they're promising to give away free money. Well, it's not free money. It's your kids' money that you're being paid for voting for them. And now let's back up a little bit and let's say, suppose it hadn't been created, then what would happen? Well, then people would know that they're not going to be taken care of by the government when they retire. They'd better take care of themselves. So they wouldn't be taxed for Social Security, and they would have more money to invest themselves in, for instance, the stock market, and use that money to support them when they retire. And let me tell you, if you look at a stock market chart from when Social Security was invented, and you do the calculations about how much money a retired person would have if he had invested in stocks instead of handing his money over to Social Security, I mean, there's a world of difference. I mean, the number of millionaires, people who would retire as millionaires, would be, you know, many, many, many times what it is today, because the government just squanders the money in most cases. It isn't just when they collect a tax from you, it isn't just for Social Security. They support, to a large extent, other governments. Like, for instance, the government of Saudi Arabia. Yeah, you and I are paying for the military protection of Saudi Arabia.
I know. You're right about this in your latest newsletter. We're talking with Richard Mayberry, Early Warning Report, and I just read my, this is a September issue, I guess, that I just got mine. I'm a subscriber, and you talk about this, and I didn't think about this. And tell folks what this is really interesting, that we the people are actually protecting all these folks in Europe.
Yeah. NATO, I think that's something like 25 countries. That includes Italy, France, Germany, you know, the big names, Britain. These so-called allies of Washington really are not allies. They're dependents of Washington because their military forces are nearly gone. After World War II, politicians in Washington promised the Europeans that they would be covered by the U.S. military. They would be protected. So for 75 years, the American taxpayer has been paying to protect the Europeans militarily. And the Europeans have known that. They're not a bunch of idiots. They can tell that they're on this military welfare, and therefore they don't need to spend money for their own protection, and they don't. So they have practically no military forces left. They use that money for their welfare states. And that makes it look like the socialism in Europe works, because the American taxpayer doesn't realize that we are paying to protect the Europeans. And that so they don't have to protect themselves. They can use their military money for their welfare system. And that's it. That's one of the big hoaxes that the Democrats are pushing, that they believe in what they call democratic socialism, and they say that it works, and Europe is the proof that it works. Well, yeah, it works if somebody else is covering your military protection. It sure does, yeah.
So that's why, one of the reasons why Mr. Trump is kind of been pounding away at NATO and the UN and that. So
yeah.
He's kind of on to something with that, I suspect.
I don't want to give any kind of a blanket pardon to Donald Trump. I think he's done a lot of things wrong, but one of the things he's done right is draw attention to the fact that these people in Europe who are quite wealthy, at least, you know, they're roughly on the same level as the United States. They should be paying for their own military protection, and you and I should not be paying for it. And he keeps coming back to that occasionally. He made a really big deal of it in the 2016 elections. But he's been wavering on it. He goes back and forth. He's not as strong about it as he used to be, because I think he's surrounded by advisors who believe in the American empire, and they want the U.S. to be the policeman of the world and all of that. So, you know, he has no military experience. He doesn't know what the military is really all about. He's never been there in the trenches and seen the craziness that goes on. So I think that... And that's a shame, too, because it used to be that practically all a very large majority of politicians had military experience. And the studies show that the more military experience they have, the less war we get into. But today, the military is looked down on to a large extent ever since the Vietnam War. There aren't very many people that really have a good feeling about it. The military has sort of taken a back seat, and people don't follow it anymore. They don't know what's going on. And they don't realize that, you know, your tax money is protecting the Europeans. That whole thing. And Europe, and, you know, Trump tried to draw attention to it, and I applaud him for that, but not much has come of it. I think that's probably because, most people just don't know anything about it.
Yes, sir. Richard Mayberry is with us, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. So, let's move along to the whole idea of giving people money and what the president's been doing with borrowing money to do these, you know, the jobs program, and they, and he did some executive orders to do more. Have you seen any more on that? Is, are these COVID relief things, do you know, do we know if they're going to continue with this these executive orders, or is he still using these to bargain to come to some kind of a, I guess, COVID part two, right? Money out the door.
Yeah. I don't know. I really hesitate to guess, because to know what they're going to do, I have to be able to read their minds, and there's not much there to read.
Can I quote you on that? I think so.
They change their minds every day. There's no ideology in Washington anymore. Mm-hmm. Used to be there was something that was called the American Way. And earlier, at the founding of the country, it was called the System of Natural Liberty. And I wish we had time to get into a full explanation of it here today, but basically the principles of the American system came out of the old British common law,
mm-hmm.
and that started developing back in the early Middle Ages. And they developed a legal system in Europe, or in Britain, in which all law, or almost all law, could be traced back to 17 words, and those 17 words are: do all you have agreed to do, and do not encroach on other persons or their property. And there's two laws there: do all you have agreed to do, and do not encroach on other persons or their property. The common law system was built up from those two principles, those two laws, and case after case, for many centuries, judges would decide on the basis of those two principles. And so you had this huge body of law, case law, that developed, and people began living their lives according to that law during the Middle Ages, and that gave rise to capitalism, where you actually were allowed to keep the money you earned and invest it in businesses, and you had the rise of industrial capitalism. It's sometimes called the Industrial Revolution, which started around 1750 or so. In America, the common law was transplanted here by the English settlers, and after the Revolution, they built the Constitution on top of the common law principles. And that's what made America probably the most successful country the world has ever seen, is this common law system that gave rise to industrial capitalism. America became the center of that progress. You know, it was, you know, it's just a spectacular thing. If you look at the way of life of human beings, by whatever measure you want to use, the amount of food, the quality of the clothing, the quality of transportation, any measure you want to use, and you track it from, let's say, 1000 BC all the way up to 1750, let's say. We'll make it the American Revolution, 1776.
Mm-hmm.
From 1000 BC to 1776, it hardly changed. A person over thousands of years lived very little better than back in the, you know, BC. And then suddenly along comes the American Revolution, and boom, the whole world starts going wild with progress, economic progress. And the typical individual is living way better than anybody that came before him. And today, you know, there's nobody from previous centuries that could possibly imagine the world we live in today, how comfortable it is for us. That's all because the American Revolution was built on those 17 words from the British common law. It made our production so much more efficient. Our ability to improve our lives became so much greater because of this system of natural liberty that the American founders believed in and tried to preserve in the Constitution.
So to do what you will, but just do whatever you agree to do with people, any kind of contracts or business, personal arrangements, and then don't mess with anybody's stuff and don't mess with their land and don't mess with their body. Just leave them alone, which is a very grungy way of expressing your 17 elegant words. And then capitalism, though, simply put, is it as simple as Mr. Mayberry that I make a widget, cost me $10, and the total my total cost with labor, everything, and I sell it for $14, and I use those $4 to, I don't know, build a house or hire some more people or whatever I do. Is that a fair representation of what capitalism is?
Yes, I would agree with that. I think you said it very well there. It's the essence of capitalism is a very simple thing: is free trade. Let me point out, human beings trade constantly. I mean, all of us spend money every day. We're trading our labor for something else that we want. Nobody makes, if he's free, if nobody's holding a gun on him and making him do it, but if he's free to choose, then nobody trades unless he gets something. This is very important. He will not trade unless he gets something that he values more than what he gives up.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So you have two people, they both produce something. One person produces apples, the other one produces oranges, and they're going to trade. Neither party will do that trade unless they get something they value more than what they give up. So in a free trade, both sides profit.
Huh.
Both sides move ahead. And the aggregate of all of the free trades in the society is what we call progress.
Huh.
And it works.
I like the way you put it. It's so just great where, the things we promote, different health products and stuff, and people pay so many Federal Reserve notes, and if they like it, right, and they feel good, if they don't, then you ask for your money back, and most of our people give you your money back if you don't like it. And then everybody's happy, and then everybody moves forward, and that's really... And so that's what built our country was built on, this very simple idea.
That's exactly right. You've got it nailed down. It's no coincidence that Adam Smith, who was one of the greatest economists in history, wrote his classic The Wealth of Nations book, and it was published in 1776.
Mm-hmm.
The American founders understood economics. And that's one of the main things they understood, is that free trade moves us forward. Free trade produces progress. And what happens, or what has happened, is in the mid-1800s, socialism came along and promised people a free lunch. You can have stuff without having to pay for it. And that's been the downfall of America now. I mean, we're headed for the rocks here because we bought into this idea that there's such a thing as a free lunch.
And I like on the idea of doing all you have agreed to, and so that goes back to being able to call up somebody that you bought something and say, I don't like this. This doesn't work. Will you take it back? And good companies do, right? Good companies will say, okay, well, bring it back. Customer's always right. And that makes everybody more, that makes the company sharper, right? Then they can kind of figure out why the guy wanted to get their stuff back. Maybe change.
That's exactly right. In a free trade that's backed by those 17 words, the individual is obligated to provide what he agreed to provide.
Mm-hmm.
And if the customer finds that it isn't what was promised, then the customer deserves to be taken care of. It's not that case in socialism. And a really good example is the public school system. About 90% of the students in the United States go to public schools. And the big problem is they aren't public schools. They aren't owned by the public. They're owned by governments. These are government agencies. A public school is a political organization. And because it's political, it has the ability to take money by force in your taxes.
Or property taxes, right?
Right. Right, usually property taxes, but there's a lot of other income taxes and all that are in that there now, too. But, you know, the public schools are supported by money that's taken forcibly from people who haven't harmed anyone. And like all political organizations, which are live off of taxes, they know they can take the money no matter how rotten a job they do. And so, all government agencies tend to be something that people laugh at because they do such a rotten job, and their people are demoralized in a lot of cases. They can't stand the disorganization and the political infighting and all the other crud that goes with government. And so, the public schools are one of the best examples. I understand, I was a public school teacher at one time, and so was my wife. Between us, we have experience in all grades, K through 12. And I understand that since we were doing that in the 1970s, it's only gotten worse and worse and worse. And today, I've seen statistics on the teacher burnout rate. About 40% of teachers quit within 5 years.
Really?
And one of their main complaints is that it's all politics. A public school is a political organization. It exists for the benefit of the government, not the students. The students are pieces on an assembly line. They go in at kindergarten, and for 13 years they go down the assembly line, and their brains are processed to believe that the government is their superhero that solves all their problems. And they come out at age 12 or at 12th grade, age 18 or so, and they believe in socialism.
And never mind the history, right, which you really get to with your Uncle Eric books, where these are great folks. I think you have what? You have two on the wars, World War One, World War Two, right? And then the Middle East War, which is really interesting. Then you write about ancient Rome, how it affects you today. Uncle Eric books, folks, these are really worth you looking at. Now, do we recommend Richard Mayberry? Folks, go to Blue Stocking Press, or where's the best place for our listeners, homeschoolers or not, to get the Uncle Eric books?
Well, Blue Stocking is the publisher.
Yeah.
They don't retail anymore.
Okay, they don't sell.
As far as I know. But you can get them. I'll give an 800 number.
Okay.
It's 800-509-5400.
800-509-5400.
That's right. And then also our website, let's see, we've been working on that. I think
it's, do you want to do the main website, or do you do the books there, Early Warning Report?
Yeah. Let's use the Ethics Solutions.
Okay.
Go to ethicssolutions.net.
Right.
And it's
that'll get you there.
Yeah, ethicssolutions.net. And all 11 Uncle Eric books are available there, as well as the handbook for
the ethics.
Ethics Solutions.
Yeah. Good. Let's take a little break here. Richard Mayberry, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. I have maybe 6, 7, 8 of these books, and just great. I remember when I had a food business years ago, I bought about 15 copies of Whatever Happened to Justice and gave them to all of my employees. I thought it was so critical that they really... great stuff on ethical behavior and justice. And it's, so it's, regardless of what your age, we really recommend these books, and very readable. He's a brilliant writer with this. Okay, this is a product that I think is worth your consideration, a great investment in your health, and it's called Brown's Gas or Molecular Hydrogen. You can go to molecularhydrogeninstitute.com and read hundreds of thousands of peer-reviewed studies on how they're using molecular hydrogen all over the world in places, you know, Mayo Clinic, and working on people with stroke victims, all cancer, all kinds of things to get this this gas, and you can breathe the gas and drink the water. Listen up. We believe by experience and the literature to back it up that distilled water bubbled with hydrogen is a very good way to go. George Wiseman is an authority on hydrogen.
98% of my fluid intake of all beverages has been distilled water that's been bubbled with the Brown's gas. I am now younger biologically than I was back then. This is why I'm saying that a lot of what happens with spring water, for example, is you get not only you might get the hydrogen, but you'll get minerals that are not necessarily bioavailable. A lot of places has excess calcium, for example. It ends up with calcium deposits in the body because you're getting too much calcium, even if it is bioavailable. Now that I've been inhaling the hydrogen, I find that I get my major nutrition, which is the hydrogen, calorie-free. So I was able to lose a few extra pounds. Mm-hmm. The cells won't regenerate. You won't have stem cells and that sort of thing if you haven't got enough hydrogen. Your cells have a certain life, and they're shutting down if they're not getting their hydrogen. They're literally dehydrating.
That's where the word comes from. Go figure. Dehydration. Which is dehydrogen.
Exactly.
Whoa. Maybe you'd like to eat a little less food and stay hydrated. We know how important hydration is. It's like key. The AquaCure machine bubbles hydrogen gas in your water and also breathe it in your body. 10% off promo code ONERADIO in our store, oneradionetwork.com. Yeah, and we're not making any medical claims here about anything. We don't do that. We know that the body, divine spirit, is the true healer. But these tools can be used. And you can see on the video here, I'm going to bend my hair down. My hair is actually coming back more and more to its natural color, where I started graying up about 40 years ago. I'm serial. Look at it. See? So again, don't buy this hydrogen and say, Patrick, my hair's still, you don't know. I'm not saying that's what it's going to do for you. We don't do that. But we've had three or four different people, and I can certainly see it. So something's going on with this. It's very, very interesting. Very, very interesting. And to Richard Mayberry's idea of do all you have agreed to do, George is such an interesting fellow. He's a good man. Check this out. He has a lifetime warranty on this unit. I mean, lifetime. Lived 120, you're good. And also, this is really fun. A 1 year money back, no questions asked warranty. Now that is cool. You know, you have a 10 months and say, man, I'm not getting anything. You can send it back. And I think he said way less than 1% of people that turned it back. You start breathing this gas and all that. And people like it. So there's something going on with it. I hope you give it a try. It is, use promo code ONERADIO. Use promo code ONERADIO. If you've never tried the colostrum, check this out from Daniel Vitalis. You know him? Yeah. Here is a little primer on colostrum.
Colostrum is this amazing food. And of course, we have it in a powdered form. So it comes kind of like a dried milk, although technically colostrum is not really a dairy product. It is the sort of first food for mammals. It's made where dairy products are made in the body, or it comes from that same place, but it's not really a milk, even though it comes from udders. And of course, all mammals produce colostrum, and they produce that colostrum to feed their young mammals. Really love the idea that if we're going to have cows and we're going to milk them, that colostrum becomes the most medicinal part of that whole system. So colostrum in human bodies, it does a lot of different things. But its primary stuff is it keeps the immune system in shape. So when we're using colostrum, it keeps our immune system kind of like going to the gym almost, like keeps it fit so that we can fight off infection. It's one of the things it does really helps us do really well. That's a natural, normal thing for us, but we're living in a world that really breaks our immune system down. So we need immuno allies. Probably nothing in the world supports our ability to stay antiviral the way colostrum does.
That's a lovely product. We've been taking it for years. Not that that means anything to you, but we have and love it. You can click and order colostrum, and you can order the 1 or 2 kilo containers. Get on the auto ship for the best price. Any Survival Link right here, OneRadioNetwork.com. And I believe we have, well, I think one more day on the sale for pine pollen on Survival. Use Pine20 as your promo code. Pine20 for the promo code. One more day. I believe it ends tomorrow midnight, last time I checked.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network.
It's the last Monday, last Wednesday of the month, sorry, and around 11 o'clock Central, 9 o'clock out there on the left coast, we talk with Richard Mayberry, the editor of Early Warning Report. You've been talking the last couple months in your newsletter and this month about longevity and some of the technologies, and you actually give some ideas about people how they can invest in this huge thing that's out there of people wanting to live longer, but being healthy and being able to play golf and whatever you do, not just, you know, sit around on the porch, you know. But I think it's interesting too, and you put a something on your newsletter about the life expectancy and how that's gone up. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
That's really wow.
Yeah, it's wow is really the word for it. one of the great benefits of the free enterprise system, what's left of it, is that it is very, very innovative, and so it's developed a whole lot of new technologies to keep us alive and healthy longer and longer. And if you look at the statistics on birth and death, going back however many centuries you want to, what you'll see is that there was almost no improvement in how long people lived until after the American Revolution. And then in the 20th century, it's like we hit some kind of a takeoff, and the improvements in medical care and public health and all sorts of other things that affect our longevity began to come dramatically. And the good statistic on it is in 1935, the typical American's life expectancy was 61 years.
Mm-hmm.
Today, it's 79 years.
Really?
Now, that's, you know, in the span of history, that's an eye blink. It's like hardly any time at all. We went from living 61 years to 79 years. And there's every reason to believe this is going to continue because these breakthroughs in medical science are coming faster and faster and in bigger and bigger ways. One of the technologies is nanotechnology,
mm-hmm.
which you know, works down at the molecular level and you know, makes things better, improves things at the molecular level. Another technology that's coming on fast is stem cell therapy, where the stem cells actually rebuild your body using your own DNA to take parts that are worn out or broken and repair them as good as new. That's coming on really fast, and there are others that I describe in the newsletter, but that's the two that I'm the most excited about, because what it means is that as we get older, we're not necessarily going to become decrepit. you know, our bodies are going to be repaired, and there's a whole lot of that repair that's already going on. The number of organs that can be transplanted is amazing, and there's 3D printing of bodily organs that's being developed. There was a case quite a few years ago, actually, you know, I think about 10 years ago, where a 3D printer was used to make a trachea for a girl who was born without one.
That's just crazy. It's like,
yeah, right. And that was like 10 years ago that was possible. You can imagine what they're working on today. They're already a research outfit in Israel has come up with a 3D printed heart.
Really?
You know, this is astounding. I mean, we're talking about something close to miracles here. So the technological advancement is moving so fast that there's a person who works for Google. He's their chief engineer, and his name is Ray Kurzweil. He's regarded as one of the most accurate forecasters in technological development that exist today. He's got all kinds of predictions that he's made over the last several decades that have come true, and because he studies this stuff all the time. And he is saying that we are pretty close, that within 10 years, in his opinion, we will see medical science adding 1 year of life to us every year. And you think about that a moment. Your lifespan is going to be expanded a year for every year you live.
Go to 80, and then that means you just don't stop for a long time.
Exactly. You just don't stop. They're going to keep repairing things. The human body is like the old proverbial chain. A chain is as strong as its weakest link. Well, what we're really closing in on is medical science being able to repair the weak links. So as things stand right now, if the weakest vital organ in my body fails, I die. But if they can replace that weakest link in my body, then I live. And they'll just be going through your whole body, and as the weakest link, whatever it happens to be at the moment, is coming up for expiration, they'll replace it.
And also, as you know, all kinds of technology, like we talk about too, on the natural end, you know, of building livers and hearts and everything with all kinds of technology and then nutrients as well. And people are getting pretty creative out there. And a lot of this stuff, you know, is quite viable. Some of it is junk, you know, but a lot of it. So no telling. Well, but this adds a challenge. There's always a flip of the coin on planet Earth, you know. Nothing exists except in relation to its opposite. So, you know, this whole Social Security thing, it kind of makes it a little bit tougher, doesn't it? Because we're going to screw up their actuary tables, right? I mean, oh, Patrick, you're supposed to be gone, dude. What are you still doing here, man? I can't be paying you. Oh, my goodness. I think, too, Mr. Mayberry, last time I checked, I think this is accurate, that we, the people, are about 200 billion a year short with Social Security payments right now. I mean, right?
Yeah, I don't know what the number is.
I think it's pretty close.
Yeah, you're right.
I think it's pretty close. Wow, so that's not going to stop, right?
Right. They're just going to have to keep raising taxes,
right? Put more money in.
Right, yeah, because any politician that gets up there and says, this is a giant Ponzi scheme, we can't do it anymore, it's going to fall apart, he's not going to get elected.
Oh, no, you can't say that kind of stuff.
Right, right.
It was funny, I think that Gore and Bush talked about this lockbox thing for about a week, and boy, they shut that down pretty quick. Remember, that just went away. Oh, we're going to put a lockbox on Social Security. Man, that just went away. Yeah. I don't want you talking about that too much, boy. Don't be, especially, you're going to lose Florida in a heartbeat, right? Whew.
Yeah.
You want to lose Florida? Talk about that.
Yeah. Well, the really great thing about this life extension industry that has developed is that it's... it's going to keep you in such good shape that you aren't going to want to sit around watching television.
You can do something.
Yeah, you're going to want to work. you're gonna go looking for a job you like. You know, there's the old saying: if you find a job you like, you'll never work another day in your life.
That's right. That's why I like that. Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that's really true. I've found it that way. I enjoy going to work in the morning. I'm 73 years old, but I love it. I still love my work, and I can't imagine being without it. So that everybody's going to be that way. You're going to be so healthy. You're going to feel like working, and so the whole Social Security thing and all that. The if there ever was a need for it, that need is going to disappear, and I think people will see. Then they'll be way able to face the fact that they're living off of their kids' money, and the Social Security then will be done away with.
Yeah, we're hearing so much talk about, well, these jobs are not coming back. I mean, you've seen the headlines, right? They're just not coming back. But, you know, you talk about, and I really appreciate it, that the economy is not this mechanical thing that you could put in a box and control, you know, like the Fed tries to do or whatever, politicians, that it's really the people. But so even through all of this, once they figure this, whatever, this COVID thing out and allow people, gosh, I can't believe I'm saying that, allow people to go back to work. My goodness. That people will figure out what to do. They're going to do something, right?
Yep.
But if we keep giving them money, they're not going to do something.
Yeah. If you keep paying them to not work, then they're not going to work. So you got to take that money away to give them the incentive to go out and get a job. And once you do, they will go out and get a job. What most politicians completely ignore, I think maybe most of them are smart enough to know it,
right,
but what they completely ignore is that humans are almost infinitely adaptable.
Mm-hmm.
We are certainly the most adaptable species on the planet, and all you have to do is leave humans alone and they will adapt.
They'll do something.
Yeah, right, yeah. Every one of them is different. We can't really predict what any given individual is going to do, but he will start trading his labor for someone else's product,
mm-hmm.
and he will thereby have a job. Because there are people that need his help, they will work it out. Is that an economy, as you say, it's not a machine like the government paints it to be, and the economists in most of the colleges go along with the government line that the economy is a machine and you can speed it up or slow it down or fine-tune it. That's all nonsense. The economy is individual human beings. In America, it's 330 million individual human beings, each of whom is different, each of whom changes every day, and more importantly, each of whom changes his mind every day. Probably many times a day.
Yes.
So you can't predict what he's going to want or what he's going to do. You cannot predict any of it. You cannot speed it up. You can't slow it down. You can't fine-tune it. These are human beings. And the economy is not a machine. It is an ecology made of biological organisms, humans. So, you know, this whole idea that the government needs to do something to make the economy better is insane, absolutely insane. There's no way they're ever going to be smart enough to make you better or make me better or any of the other 330 million people. We're all different.
and plus, the government really, Richard Mayberry, doesn't have any money. I mean, we the people are, what, $27 trillion in bonded debt? So they don't have any money, so we keep borrowing more money, and I think the interest on the debt, did we go talk about that last week? I think it's close to $500 billion a year. I sent that email to Samantha, yeah. Crazy. I mean, just the interest on the debt.
What? Yep. Yeah. The federal government is bankrupt. There's no doubt about
that. No doubt about it.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
I mean, it's expensive to buy votes, you know.
It costs a lot of money. But you see, now here's a new headline. You know, these headlines keep coming out there are forces out there that sure want to tell you that what you've just said is false. Here's half of NABE respondents, whatever that is, you know, these headlines, believe return to 29 growth levels could take years. You know, so they're saying, well, it's going to take years before people are going to get up and do something. How do they know that? They don't know that.
Right.
They don't know that.
These 330 million people, every one of whom has a free will, and these people are predicting what these people are going to do.
And I think it's hilarious, yeah. But boy, that, you know, people playing the markets, I guess, that's what they kind of go by, some of the hedge funds and all these things, right? Ooh, mm-hmm. Man. But are you okay? I guess you talk a lot about in your newsletter, Early Warning Report. You're a real persnickety guy about what you put your money into as far as stocks, right? Talk a little bit about the recommendations that you've made over the years and how you do it.
I have researchers who work for me, and my particular talent that I apparently was born with is to be a big picture guy. I really like to get deeply into what causes big things to happen, and the large currents. You know, as we were talking about earlier, that's an example, right? That the Industrial Revolution began in 1750 and the things that caused it to happen, all that. That's my kind of stuff. And so I watch what's going on around the world and I try to figure out what is actually happening behind the scenes. And, I use history to do an awful lot of that. And I get a picture in my mind of what I think of some development that is on the way. And then I'll tell my researchers, here is what I think is going to happen. Now you find me investments that will profit from that if I'm right. And that's how our whole early warning report system works. I make the big picture forecast, and then my researchers go out and find the investments that will profit if I'm right.
And then what I like, too, is you always put your confidence level. Right, so you have a number there so people know how risky this is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, every investment involves risk. Whatever it is you own, somebody may have told you it's safe. It's not. There's no such thing as safety. There are degrees of safety. Some things are safer than others, but there's nothing that's safe. So I always try to talk about risk. The famous financial advisor, Harry Brown, one time said that as far as he knew, I was practically the only guy in the world that talks about money and talks about risk along with the money. So I want my readers to understand that I'm not offering them any kind of a sure thing. I try to offer things that are lower risk, but there's no such thing as no risk. And so you have to... among other things that I harp on all the time is you've got to diversify because you don't really know what's going to happen. And the three most important rules in investing are diversify, diversify, diversify. You can never be too diversified, I don't think. Maybe you can, but I've never seen it.
But there's obviously no way of knowing, for example, I suspect, I don't know, but that the airline stocks over the last 6 months have really taken a beating. Those kind of things, you're just going to lose money if you're in, huh?
Well, from here on out, I don't know. I think, as far as any particular airline, I don't have any favorite there. I think they're all in trouble, and I can't see anybody that's got much of an advantage. Except maybe Alaska Airlines, being serving the far north, which is getting warmer and warmer all the time, looks to me like a really good business model. So Alaska Airlines might be an exception there. And then as far as the producers of the aircraft, I would like to say Boeing is probably a good speculation right now, but it's it's not low enough risk for me to get into it. Mm-hmm. And I am in Alaska Airlines now, mm-hmm. that I think about it. I haven't gotten worried about them like I have all the rest of the aviation industry.
So understanding Keynesian ideas where money printing is like what keeps it going and borrowing from the Fed, have you done well and your people with just being in gold and silver and numismatics and staying there, just staying in?
Oh, yeah. The numismatics, meaning collector coins,
right.
Not so much lately, but I think that's going to change. But just the basic bullion coins, and not just gold, but gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. Oh, man, they have done so well. And I've been recommending the precious metals since 1971, I think it was.
Wow.
And if you go back and you track the performance of the precious metals since 1971, you're going to have a hard time finding anything that's done better. Now, there are things that went, Amazon and Apple, there are things that have done better, much, much, much better, but that have done better for that length of time, I don't know if you can find anything or not.
Yeah, back to 71.
Wow. Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
Back in the Harry Brown days.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Harry was possibly the first big name to get out there and start promoting the precious metals. And he sure was right. I mean,
what was his book, Richard? How to Be Free in an Unfree World. Remember that?
That's one of them. Yeah. That's a good book. Yeah, Harry Brown's How to Be Free. How you can find freedom in an unfree world.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. But his devaluation book, How You Can Profit from the Coming Devaluation, that one was the real big breakthrough for him because he hit the nail on the head perfectly. I can remember, I believe it's that book, where he started out saying, in a few years, a Volkswagen will cost $3,500. And that was at a time when a Volkswagen was $1,500. And I thought, this guy's nuts. That can't possibly happen. And he was right. It happened. And the book explains, he starts at the very basic level of economics of what is money, and gives you an example of people trading nails as money. And they trade them back and forth, and the nails eventually evolve into something that is a store of value. He goes through all of this in very much the same way that I do in the Uncle Eric books. I try to keep things as simple as possible so the reader can grasp it in just a few seconds. And that's the way Harry wrote that book. And boy, oh boy, was he right about his predictions about what gold and silver were going to do back then.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's fascinating to look at some of the blogosphere and the blogs world and the Fed. And the Fed is really, it appears to me, from the bleachers here, kind of really paving the way that this inflation we're going to see is going to be good. So you're going to like this. Right? This will be fine. You'll like it. It won't hurt a bit, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is insane. I mean, devaluing the money will be fun.
That's right. That's what they're telling us.
Yeah. Right. The interesting thing about it is they keep talking about how inflation's a good thing now.
Right.
In the 70s, people were terrified of it. But, it's a good thing now. If you look back at the 1800s, that was the century when laissez-faire capitalism was dominant, and the Industrial Revolution really took off. There's never been a period of development that was as swift as that was during the 1800s. And because that's when economies were the most free, when humans had the most economic freedom. So, there's a tremendous advanced. I remember, you know, the thing I like to point to is transportation.
Mm-hmm.
They began the 1800s with the fastest a person could go would be maybe over a long distance would be maybe 3 or 4 miles an hour riding a horse.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended the century where you could sit in a nice, warm, comfortable railroad car going 70 miles an hour.
In 100 years?
Yeah, in 100 years, there was that much progress.
Wow.
So, you know, I look back at that, and gosh, I can't remember where I was going with this.
That's all right. No, don't worry about, you know, I like it when you do that, though, and we think about it, because to use your term earlier, Mr. Mayberry, a blip. And if you look at evolution, right, and go back, you know, a couple thousand years B.C., 100 years is like what? It's just like, and you can go from 2 miles an hour to 100 miles an hour. Man, let's take a phone call for you. Good morning. You're on the air with Richard Mayberry. Who's this? Hello? Oh, wait a minute. Okay, I got you now. Go ahead. You're on the air. Hello? Hello? That was kind of exciting, wasn't it? Don't you like live radio there, Richard Mayberry? That's great. Now, folks, it's pretty good. When you do that, you want to say something when you call, and that'll be great. Richard Mayberry with Early Warning Report. So before we get out of here, let's talk a bit about China. You're talking about it more and more in your newsletters.
Mm-hmm.
So here we have, what, 1.3 billion? Is it possible that they have like 4 times what we have in as far as humans? I guess so, right?
Oh, well.
4 times 3 is 12, right? 1.2? Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, I use that number, but I'm always
We're
nervous
not sure,
about
huh?
it.
Exactly.
Yeah, because these are Chinese statistics, and the Chinese government is a government.
Yeah.
They lie.
Yeah, well,
so
I forgot about that part.
Yeah, right. Governments lie. That's a law of history, you know, that goes back 10,000 years. Governments lie. So how many people do they have? I don't know, but it's a lot.
So what do you make of this? So this Huawei thing with the 5G, they were going to take over the world with it. And boy, President Trump put a real stamp on that puppy, said, and they did it all with what? It would be insecure, you know, that kind of thing. And then the TikTok, mm-hmm. and then all the tariffs and there's, it looks like there's a real Cold War building here,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of like what years gone by with the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
What's your opinion?
Oh, absolutely. I think you're totally right about that. I think that both sides, put it this way, both governments need a war.
What?
And,
don't tell me that. No, I don't want to hear that.
So. Yeah. You know, when things get really bad, governments start worrying about riots in the streets and revolution and assassination. They really worry about assassination. And they need some way to rally the population behind them and see them as heroes.
Oh.
So that they don't lose their power and possibly get killed. So they always are looking for what the mobs are doing. And, you know, if there are very few mobs in the street, then governments relax. But if you get more mobs in the street, they start getting scared. And they need a way to create loyalty among the population and to have the population see them as heroes. And the way to do that, that always works, is a war. So as things in the world stand now, both governments really need a war. And you can see them squaring off against each other.
Yeah.
Not because there's any kind of a moral or ethical principle at stake. It's just because that's a benefit to them to scare the populations into being loyal to them. And it's, I think, I don't know how much of that is consciously done in Washington, but sure. I'm sure it's absolutely consciously being done in Beijing. They are moving in the direction of war because they really, really need to rally the population behind them, because they've got some kind of an economic catastrophe coming, and they know it, and they are trying to get the population on their side before it hits. Because if you look at China's history, it's horrible. I mean, there has never been any other place on Earth anywhere near as bloody as China. There, you know, while maybe the French and the Germans and other populations have revolutions that kill 10,000 or 100,000, Chinese revolutions kill millions, and sometimes tens of millions.
Wow.
You can look at the population statistics, the censuses that go back many, many centuries in China, and there are times when the population just like is cut in half by their revolutions. So they really, really get scared when the possibility of economic trouble arises, and it has arisen.
Yeah, and you've written before that's really one of the big things that the government of China worries about is people storming the castle, right? Because
yep.
Chinese people, they must be in their DNA that they, you know, they things get really strange, boy. They just go, don't they? They just...
Yeah. You know, people, I'm probably not the first person to point out that people in crowds do not behave well. and the more they're crowded, the more badly they behave.
Yeah.
And the Chinese, you know, those cities are really packed. And they've always been that way, you know, for many, many centuries. So I think that has some big effect on it. People in crowds go nuts, and they have the biggest crowds in the world. So
yes, hey, here's an email from Gary for you. Mr. Mayberry, I'm enjoying the show. It seems to me that no, regardless of who wins in November, that there's going to be people that are going to be very angry. Good point. What do you think this will mean to my 401ks, and I'm in the stock market? That's a good question. So he's probably right. No matter who wins, Mr. Mayberry, that there's going to be a lot of angry people?
Oh, I think that's a pretty close to a certainty. The country really is divided in a way that I haven't seen in my lifetime, except during the Vietnam War
sir.
A few years. You know, it's essentially dividing along the line of the socialists versus the anti-socialists. And there's not going to be a reconciliation. There's not going to be a compromise. That's just too big of a divide. You have one part of the population, the socialists, who think that one man's need is another man's obligation. If I need something, you've got an obligation to provide it to me. And that means essentially what the other side understands, the anti-socialists understand, is that, well, if my need is your obligation, doesn't that mean that you are my slave? And the more I need, the more you have to provide. And is there a limit to this? If I get really, really bad off, do you just have to give me everything you have? See, there's the anti-socialists understand that. There's no dividing line that says, there's no place to stop and say, no, we're not going to take any more of your money. They never promise, the socialists never promise, oh, we'll only take this much and we'll never, ever take any more. They don't. They don't have a limit. And so the anti-socialists are scared to death of the socialists. And I don't think there's a way to reconcile that. You can't, after having robbed a person year after year, decade after decade, you can't come along and say, we promise we're not going to rob you anymore. They're not going to believe it. So this country's in a situation here where there cannot be a relaxation of the tensions.
Yes, and they're already building, whoever they are, right? They're already building this possibility of, you know, the votes won't be counted for 2 months, and President Trump is not going to accept the results. And so it's almost like people are building for something really dumb to happen this fall, like they want it, you know, like divide and conquer thing, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know about that. That generally, you know, governments don't think in terms of divide and conquer. They think in terms of unity. They want the whole country behind them.
Right.
You hear them talking about unity all the time. We've got to stop this factionalism, and we've got to all get together and be just Americans. That's all, just Americans. What that means is, I want you to be loyal to me. I don't want to be thrown out of office.
I want you to do what I'm saying. But I guess there could be some more higher up influences, potentially, you know, the globalists and the people that want, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, more control and more stuff like that. Well, we're in for a ride here. Here's one for you. Let's see. From Mark, he says, Mr. Mayberry stated that inflation was bad in the 70s, but it's good now. Why is that? Oh.
Well, that's not me saying
no,
that.
No, that's not. What did you say? You were saying that Jimmy Carter was walking around with whip inflation now buttons, remember?
Mm-hmm.
But now the Fed is saying that it's a good thing. So I guess that's what he's alluding to.
Yes, right. Yeah, and that's what I was pointing to. Yeah, that, you know, inflation is always and everywhere a bad thing, you know, because all money is a store of value. And if you start reducing the value that's in the money by printing huge amounts of it, because money responds to the law of supply and demand, just like everything else, if you start reducing the supply, then the value, then that you're stealing people's savings. So, nah. There I am. I got distracted. I can't remember where I was going.
Yeah, well that's okay. It's the idea that I guess that the Fed is kind of wanting to sell the idea that this thing will be fine and it's not going to stop until we run out of zeros, right?
Yeah.
it's just not going to stop.
The bottom line on it is the Federal Reserve doesn't know what they're doing. And you know, they've got a job that's an impossible job. It just cannot be done, and everybody knows it. You only have to watch them for a few years, and you realize they don't know what they're doing. This is all guesswork, because they got a model that assumes that the economy is a machine, and it's not a machine. It's biological. So, you know, the gentleman asked, you know, what's going to happen to my 401k? And the answer is nobody knows, because the Fed bureaucrats change their minds day after day, because they don't know what they're doing and they have to pretend like they do know. So it's you know, the Fed is just a part of socialism. It is a central planning for the monetary system. It's socialist to the core, and it doesn't work. You cannot have anybody, any human being, who has the wisdom to know what's good for other human beings, especially not 330 million of them. You might know what's good to some extent for your wife or your kid. But that's about at the limit of it, you know, because you don't know anybody else very well. So how are you going to know what's good for them? But the socialism and the Federal Reserve are based on the assumption that these experts know what's good for you and me. And they don't. They can't.
What do you think, before we go, are the biggest unknowns that our listeners, you know, should be aware of that could really affect their financial well-being that are out there floating around that could pop up, I guess, in the next few months or the election? You know what I'm getting at? Kind of some things that you're kind of look at and concerned about as far as the mechanics of this thing called the economy?
Oh, wow.
Would it be just more, perhaps, more money printing, or...
Probably going to be that. That's always a good bet. Yeah. They might slow it down for a while, but...
They're not going to stop that.
Yeah, they won't stop it for very long. So, yeah, you can be very confident that the value of the dollar will continue falling, which mm-hmm. means it will be very, very hard on your savings since the Federal Reserve has given us near zero interest rates. You have the creation of the money increasing dramatically. The value of each individual dollar is falling, and you can't make up for it with the interest rate because they wreck that too.
Yeah.
So I guess you can say a really firm forecast is that the Federal Reserve will continue wrecking the economy.
Would that then be a selling point for taking possession of the these precious metals as a kind of real safe, you know, nothing safe. There's always risk, as you say, but as one of the maybe the safest? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you think it is?
It's one of the safest. It should be definitely part of your diversification. And I totally agree with you. You want bullion coins. This is where you should start. You should have, in my opinion, between 10 and 20% of your financial net worth in bullion coins split evenly among gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. And you should get either American coins or Canadian maple leaf coins.
And bullion, to be clear, then these are just, they're not really real money that's used in commerce. They're just like coins that have a fixed amount of gold or silver, correct? Is that what you call bullion coins?
Yep, that's right.
And then spread them out, platinum, the whole thing.
Yeah, gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. Mm-hmm. I would go, you know, a fourth in each.
Mm-hmm.
And again, 10 to 20% of your financial net worth. And I don't know what they add beyond that. So
yeah. What would be next as far as safety, in your opinion?
After the precious metals?
Yes, sir. Not a lot up there, is there?
No, there's not. A wide variety of really high quality stocks.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to use the word safety because there really isn't any safety anymore as long as the Federal Reserve exists.
Yes, sir.
Because these people can change their minds anytime they want, and whatever plans you have made can go down the tubes whenever they change their minds. So it's a case of just diversify like crazy, and you need to have a broker who understands Austrian economics and who is a broken field runner, who watches the markets constantly and moves from one hot spot to the next. And there are very, very, very few people who can do that.
So you want to interview people and really get an idea.
Yeah.
And if they say, well, what's Austrian school? Well, then you just want to move on from there, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly. If they don't understand Austrian economics, that's the economics of Friedrich Hayek, mm-hmm. who won the Nobel Prize for economics back in the 70s. And there's a whole group of economists who follow his models. In my opinion, if you're not using Austrian economics, you're in deep trouble. You have no chance of coping with the Federal Reserve.
Okay, a final question for you, then you get to go back and enjoy the sunshine out there, is, so let's assume that there are some people, or correct, are out there saying, be careful because there are forces that will try to bomb the stock market just to hurt President Trump. I mean, that could happen. Would these high quality stocks that you've been recommending for years and even in all your newsletters, can they withstand that? If that's something like that would happen, if they would really, you know, the plunge protection team and all these people would go in there and just bomb this thing just to get Mr. Trump out, which I guess is possible. I don't know.
It's possible. And I don't know what to say beyond that.
Yeah.
you just don't know. The one stock, type of stock that I like the best is defense stocks. Because all you have to do is look at a chart of them. I first started recommending them around 1990. So look at a chart of defense stocks since 1990, and you'll see why I like them so much. The one thing governments really like to do is get into wars, and so the defense stocks are a way of getting some of your tax money back when they go up, which they do over the long term.
And you can see the charts on those. You can see them and seeing that you're just not making this up. I mean,
yeah, right. You know, look at Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed, especially Lockheed. And my favorite under conditions today is Huntington Ingalls. You know, they make warships, and Washington is headed for a naval war with China.
With China.
So, yeah, so I think Huntington Ingalls is a really good buy.
Huntington Ingalls.
Right. You know, I've got to go here.
Yeah, we're right on time. Thanks so much. I really enjoy it. Honor to have you here. And Early Warning Report, get on there and get his newsletter. You get into some really interesting things. EthicsSolutions.net, and you can learn about that. And then the Uncle Eric series books, they are on, you said Ethics Solutions, right? That's where we want to go for the Uncle Eric series.
Yes.
Right. Mr. Mayberry, thank you. We will see you last Wednesday in September, sir.
I will look forward to it. And again, thank you for doing such a great job here, Patrick.
Well,
I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. I appreciate it. Thank you, sir. Richard Mayberry, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. Hour and a half, once a month. Well, we love those big, broad, big thinker pictures kind of guys. Huh? I hope you enjoyed as much as we have having Mr. Mayberry on. So, okay, we're going to take a day off. I got some more ideas. We're polishing up on screenplays and I'm going to get back into getting our book finished that we're working on. And so I appreciate your support and being able to have a little bit of free time here on Thursdays and on the weekends and at nights now to work on my writing projects. And so I'm so grateful that you're there to support us with buying these products that we promote when you can. People send us some few bucks a month too, and we manage to do it, and we're very grateful that you choose to come here from time to time. Please pass on our links to everyone that you care about. I think you're going to find some things here with our open phones that we talk about in soul, mind, body, and the healing things and spiritual growth that I think are valuable, and then all the different people we have on like Richard Mayberry, to Richard Massey and Dr. Daniels and all the other people. So I love you all very much. Thank you. See ya. See you soon. We will see you on Friday, right, at 1 o'clock. Patrick Timpone, and may the blessings be.
Nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.